Hello and welcome back to another edition of the Dog and Duck Show. We are in week 10. The Dogs are 9-0. The Ducks are 8-1. Huskies are number 5 in the nation in the most recently released CFP poll. The Ducks once again are quacking at their heels at number 6. Mark, there, as we've said many times over the last year or so, there has never been a better time to host a show called the Dog and Duck Show. And our Huskies and our Ducks have not disappointed. How are you doing, my friend?
Well, I think if you told the two of us when we walked through the schedules at the beginning of the year that one of us would be 9-0, the other one would be 8-1 with a 3-point loss to the other one, we would have said that's perfect for this show. Of course, I would have rather switched positions with you. But even if you told me when we mapped out those schedules that Oregon would be 8-1 and they would have split their road games with Washington and Utah, that's exactly what I would have, you know, hoped for at the beginning of the year when we were mapping out the schedules. So,
I feel like you did say that. I mean, if my memory serves me correctly, I said the perfect scenario would be if both teams were undefeated except for UW narrowly beating Oregon at home to set up what would be the ultimate battle, which is a Pac-12 championship game, which we're barreling closer and closer towards as the season comes to an end.
Right. And I think I had Oregon going 11-1 with a loss to Utah and Washington going 11-1 with a loss to Oregon was my favorable scenario.
Okay.
Set up. But you know, the truth is I think we all looked at our respective schedules, saw kind of four games that you circle against the other major contenders, two on the road, two at home, and thought we really need to win the home games. And if we can split the two road games, we'll be in pretty good shape by the end of the year. Oregon had the road games first. Now they've got to take care of business at home. Washington took care of business at home, or has taken care of business at home against Oregon and on
thus
the road
far.
USC, and now has two more left on their docket. So altogether, good shape for both schools heading into the stretch run for sure.
Absolutely. And you know, you talked about circling dates on the calendar, and for Husky fans, one of the biggest dates on the calendar at the beginning of the season was going to Los Angeles in the Coliseum to play the USC team coached by Lincoln Riley, led by Heisman Trophy winner Caleb Williams. And Mark, this kind of sparked a text debate between you, me, and the other guys who are part of this kind of this podcast thread around the definition of the word upset. And I just want to touch on this for just a moment, that we went in circles for longer than I care to admit about whether or not Washington going on the road, losing to an uber talented team with a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback in a game that was only separated by 3 points by Vegas, whether or not that qualified as an upset. And I think where we landed, and Mark, you can comment on this if you disagree, I think where we landed on this was that if the blanket term for upset is anytime a lower ranked team defeats a higher ranked team, it will always be an upset, then yes, that would have been an upset. My argument was that the word is a little bit more nuanced than that, that there are games where it's ultimately a coin toss type of game. And if you lose in one of those games, it doesn't really qualify as an upset. The Huskies losing against Stanford, upset. The Huskies losing against ASU, upset. The Huskies going on the road and losing a narrow game to USC, as I described, not an upset. But Mark, you and several others on our text thread were very passionate that this had to be an upset.
Well, I think You're describing a portion of the conversation that I think got a little sidetracked from an initial point that I was trying to make. I did a ton of research, which I think I shared on the show last week, about the difficulty of winning in November when you've got a really good team. And I presented all of this data, and I went back and I looked at the Don James era, and I looked at the history of Oregon football, and that there are all these years where these teams come into November riding high. You pencil out the rest of the schedule and you say, we should be favored in all four games in November. Here it is. And then almost inevitably a team drops one of those games. And so I shared all of this data, and you made a quip where you showed last November's Washington schedule. And you said something like, well, what's Kalen DeBoer's record in November compared to Dan Lanning's? And I was like, Warren, you're totally missing the point. Last year, Washington did not enter November with a top 10 ranking. They did not enter November with national title hopes. It was a totally different scenario. And you said, well, they played a tougher schedule last year. And I said, no, you're missing the point. All of these losses in November are upset losses. They're teams losing to teams they should be beating, teams that are ranked behind them, oftentimes teams that are even unranked. So when I was using the upset term, yes, I was using it very broadly to just say that it's the type of game that when you're penciling out the schedule, you're saying we should be favored to win all of these games. So Washington has three of their last four games against ranked opponents, USC, Utah, the Beavers. None of these would be like a monstrosity if they lost them, right? None of these are like the type of thing where you're wanting to like string up Coach DeBoer or something like that. Like,
exactly.
These would all be recognizable, understandable, you know, types of defeats in the world of college football. At the same time, these are all games that right now you're penciling in and you're saying we should be favored in every single one of the games. These are all teams that we should beat if we play our game. That's the point that I was making, is that kind of the heartbreak that oftentimes befalls teams in November hits teams when they're feeling exactly like our two fan bases are feeling, which is we're sizing up the rest of the schedule. We're starting to make plans about being in Las Vegas. And then some team that you'd kind of checked the box as that's a win, they play their best game of the season. And all of a sudden your head is spinning because your team took a loss that you didn't see coming.
Absolutely. And again, I think you're right in the same, I think we're agreeing on this main fact that if a team like USC comes into Autzen next week and they play their best game and beat Oregon, I mean, you could say that's an upset, especially now that they're not even ranked, especially since they're on the road. But, you know, you look at the talent and you go, okay, like this is a team that had all the tools to win this game. They just, you know, they had kind of made their own mistakes and blunders to lose games, but the talent was always there. And I think same thing, like, again, it's a little bit different. Like if we were going on the road this weekend to Utah and Utah beat us, I wouldn't consider it an upset, but being at home, we should win. If Utah does beat us when we're at home, that does kind of fall more into that upset category for me. But there's a good chance that we'll face Oregon State in 2 weeks and they're gonna be ranked number 12 or 13 in the country, and if they win at home, I'm not gonna be like, oh man, I can't believe that happened, how could we have possibly lost to those guys, because those things happen, you know, as Dan Lanning and the Oregon Ducks know very well. So, but
Warren, you will though, because let me tell you, when your team is 10-0, going into game 11, even if it's like, I remember an Oregon team that was 10-0 hosting a Stanford team that was maybe ranked, I want to say like 14th or something. And Oregon was ranked number one and we lost 17-14 in overtime to Stanford. And that was a respectable Stanford team. David Shaw, I think they finished in the top 10. You know, that was the run where Stanford was always good every year.
Yeah.
But that game has haunted me as much as any Oregon game has, because it
the what if
season, you know.
Yeah.
Now, Washington is in a position where with the 14 playoff, maybe they can still get a bit of a mulligan, although this year that's shaky. I know we're going to get into that later on, but like you will be haunted by that loss, and it's no disrespect to the Beavers, but you're going to think about that, especially then if the Beavers go out and lose by 3 touchdowns to the Ducks the following week. You're going to be like, oh my goodness, how did we not get past that Oregon State game? It's going to haunt you regardless, just because that's the way these things work.
No, there's no doubt. If we go into Oregon State 10-0 and lose, we'll never get over it. But, you know, that is a part of the nature of college football. I mean, Mark, you're the historian. How many undefeated Pac-12 teams have we seen since the introduction of the college football playoffs?
Zero.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, to presume that this is the year, and maybe it is, but to presume this is the year, you know, that's a little bit, well, it's presumptuous. So we're going to move on, because the Huskies were not upset against USC. They did take care of business. And you know, this continues to build UW's, resume, I think, for the season. They've now beaten the top 3 teams in the conference as it stands right now: Oregon, USC, and Arizona. 2 of those 3 games being on the road, and they still have the next 2 teams in the top 5 of the Pac-12 coming up in number 18 Utah and number 16 Oregon State. So, a great resume builder this past weekend. This game against USC, we all penciled it in as being Penix versus Williams. And there's no doubt about it. Neither one of those quarterbacks disappointed. Michael Penix had one of the most incredible scramble and throw plays of his entire career to Devin Culp in the corner of the end zone. He graded out, according to Ryan Grubb, his best game of the season, even though he only finished with 256 yards passing, 2 touchdowns passing, 1 touchdown running, and an interception. It was still a great game. He stayed within himself. But no one is going to remember this as Penix versus Williams. They are going to remember this as the Dylan Johnson game. And I can honestly say I did not see this coming. Not in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that Dylan Johnson would carry the ball 26 times for 256 yards, 4 touchdowns, and that the offensive line would dominate USC in a way that they were never even able to dominate Tulsa on this level. So what they did against USC was truly phenomenal. And I'm sure Oregon fans have to be licking their chops, you know, preparing for USC this weekend, seeing what Washington did to them on the ground, which, you know, the ground is not our forte. So really an amazing game from start to finish.
The number that caught my eye, Warren, wasn't the 256 yards. It was 199 yards before contact.
Yeah.
Before a USC defender touched him, he racked up 199 yards on those carries, which is just absurd. I mean, there were so many carries where he's just running free and there's nobody getting a hand on him. But, you know, we talked about this going into the game, that we felt like there are easy yards to get on the ground for both teams. But who is going to be the more patient team? Both of these offensive coaches really like to air it out. They've got these talented quarterbacks. They've got these talented receiving cores. Who is going to be the patient team and just take those yards on the ground when they're there? And I added it up, Warren. Washington had 31 passing plays and 41 rushing plays. So they
unbelievable.
They stayed disciplined on that. USC, 39 passes, just 24 rushing plays, even though they averaged 7.5 yards a carry. Now, part of that is their star running back, Marshawn
Lloyd,
did not play. But the guy that they had in there was averaging like 10 yards a carry every time he touched the ball.
Austin Jones is a bona fide, star. and, you know, and he was fresh because he hasn't been playing as much this year. He looked like he was, you know, an NFL ready running back from start to finish. So you're absolutely right. USC had the run as much as they wanted it for most of the game. They relied on their, you know, mesmerizing quarterback, and Caleb Williams was truly remarkable. I mean, I found myself in awe of what he could do out on the field. But one thing that has been an Achilles heel for Caleb Williams has been sacks and turnovers.
Yeah.
He's been sacked frequently, and he leads the nation in turnovers over the last 2 years at the quarterback position. And that ultimately came back to bite him. In one of the more, you know, movie-worthy moments, Zion Tupuola-Fatui, otherwise known as ZTF, came in at the end of the second quarter, crashed in on Caleb Williams, got the strip sack. Braylon Trice, his partner in crime, picked it up. That ultimately ended up becoming the defensive play of the game for both teams. And what's so remarkable about that is that just a week earlier, immediately following the Stanford game, ZTF found out that his dad had passed away. And, you know, just brutal, heartbreaking news to receive for someone at that age. His dad loved watching him play. He had promised his dad that he would get a strip sack this season. And then to do it in that game, in that moment, on that stage,
yeah,
against that quarterback, I mean, that was unbelievable. And, you know, Softy interviewed him after the game, and he was in tears. There's a beautiful, you know, video of head coach Kalen DeBoer, you know, just hugging ZTF after the game, and ZTF's just crying into his shoulders. You know, it's just a powerful reminder that, you know, these guys are not just action figures that you kind of just put on the field and move around. They're real people with real issues and struggles. And Mark, it kind of reminded me of, and I don't know what will come from this story from here on out, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of what happened last year with Wayne Talapapa, almost right around this time, where, of course, you may remember Talapapa was a transfer, grad transfer from UVA, and there was the tragic UVA shootings, which occurred and ultimately ended up resulting in the death of three of his former teammates. All that happened before the Colorado game. Talapapa, who had 100-yard game previous to that point in the season, ran for over 100 against Colorado, did it again, and then did it again against Washington State in the Apple Cup, and then ultimately really carried the Huskies in their bowl game against Texas, and finished the season as one of the most dynamic Husky, you know, running stretches over three games that we've seen in years. So, you know, how much of that had to do with him really kind of dedicating the season to those fallen teammates? How much of that had to do with just where the Husky offense was at in that moment, the defenses they played? That can be debated, but certainly you wonder if this is going to be the kind of thing where ZTF and his teammates rally and they say, hey, we're going to rise up for our brother and in honor of his dad. And what will the rest of the story be as we see this season unfold?
Yeah. I mean, it was a really moving moment for anybody that knew the background, even if you were rooting against the Huskies, as I was. although it's hard to root against the Huskies when they're playing USC. I felt like it was kind of a Sophie's Choice moment and didn't really have a team to root for. But,
Mark, to be honest, like, you know, you probably are not going to like me saying this, but I never really considered Oregon much of a rival when I was growing up. It was USC.
That doesn't surprise me.
We hated USC. The Trojans were the ones that we wanted to beat. Oregon was just another team on the schedule at that 100%. Point.
Yeah, that makes sense for how old you are, Warren.
I know. I mean, I'm ancient. You know, I was. It's like someone said the other day. They're like, "So you were alive before the internet?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah." Life was pretty sweet back then. But the
only thing I wanted to add here, Warren, was aside from the, I mean, just the touching nature of what that moment was for ZTF and everything about that. There was that particular sack, which directly led to 7 points just before the half, which if they don't get a sack there and they just force a punt, Washington doesn't score before the half. They didn't have enough time. And then there's the sack in the fourth quarter. You know, the Trojans finally held Washington to a field goal. So Caleb Williams was driving with a chance to put them up instead of just tie the game. They have a touchdown called back on a holding penalty, which was a good call, puts them back at the 30-yard line. They're just on the edge of field goal range. And then Caleb Williams takes another sack. You're going to have to help me out on the name of
that. Boyce Anufi.
Yeah, there you go. Those were by far the two most consequential plays of the game from a defensive perspective. And they were just two plays that, like, if you're a USC fan, you've just got to be pulling your hair out, because as awesome as Caleb Williams is, those are two situations where you cannot take a sack for any reason whatsoever. Like, you just have to get rid of the ball there. And those were, I mean, that was a 10-point swing, the touchdown before the half, kicking him out of field goal range in the fourth quarter. And what was the final margin? It was a 10-point margin. Those were the two most critical plays of the game. And credit to the USC or the Washington defense, because Caleb Williams is not an easy guy to track down. There were a lot of times where they put pressure on him and he was able to escape it and make a great play by finding a receiver downfield, because it's a long time to cover downfield. So to come through with a sack in those two moments and have it affect the game the way that they did was enormous.
Absolutely. And I'll try to avoid a major rabbit trail here, but, you know, just a little footnote, because, you know, you represent the Ducks. The Huskies, of course, are playing USC. And both those teams are typically known for having a lot of highly ranked recruiting talent on their team. Just a little footnote that ZTF, he was discovered by the University of Washington. When he got, when he committed to UW, he was a low 3-star. Same with Voight Tanufi, low 3-star. Nobody else really wanted him, but the Huskies saw something in him. And Tanufi is an interesting guy because he's an undersized defensive tackle that this year got moved to the edge to try to help kind of give some extra support to Trice and ZTF. But for this game, because of Caleb Williams and his mobility, they moved him back in to the defensive tackle position. And that turned out to be a brilliant decision because it resulted in that sack. But Tanufi is, he's not a full-time starter for this team, but he has had some of the most consequential sacks over the last two seasons out of anyone on our team, maybe more so than Trice, which is saying something, since Trice is probably going to be a first-round draft pick. Tanufi just has a nose for the ball at critical moments. And it's just a fun thing to watch when you see a guy that kind of came in, nobody really wanted him, but he's got the knack, whatever that is. He's got the knack, and he did it again on Saturday night. So exciting for him, but great game. One other thing that I wanted to mention is Jalen McMillan once again was out. And so the Huskies, I think, are starting to realize that they're going to have to just imagine an offense without Jalen McMillan. Yeah, apparently he's gone to some of the some of the Seattle Seahawks training staff to get some, you know, second opinions on his knee. But in his place, Giles Jackson came in again. Of course, he was a hero for us in the Oregon game. Had some critical catches once again for the Huskies this past week. Didn't really amass a lot of yards because we didn't pass a lot, but his presence was felt. And I wanted to clear something up, Mark, that we talked about last week on the show related to Giles Jackson. I heard this in an interview with Coach DeBoer earlier this week, but the way that the eligibility works is that you are only allowed to play up to four games in the regular season. And so Giles is going to be going into this Utah game on Saturday. That'll be his fourth game playing this season. If he plays the game, then he's going to have to make a decision whether or not he wants to play against Oregon State and Washington State and retain his eligibility and play one more year next year, or burn it and he'll be done. He's a senior. But I did get clarification that the Pac-12 championship game and any bowl or playoff games do not count towards the four-game minimum. So ultimately, he can, if he decides to skip out on Oregon State and Washington State, he can then resume playing in the Pac-12 championship game, assuming we make it there, and in whatever bowl or playoff situation we're in. So just wanted to clear that up. That wasn't really a point of controversy. It was just a point where I didn't really know the answer last week on the show.
Well, and it's helpful to have that clarity. Don't you think that the Jalen McMillan news directly relates whether they would want to use that full eligibility? Like, I would think if the prognosis is Jalen McMillan is likely out at least through the end of the regular season, then you would not be concerned about trying to protect this as a redshirt season, and you would want to have Giles Jackson playing, wouldn't you?
I would think so. I mean, excuse me. I would think so. I think, you know, most likely they're going to leave that decision up to him because it is his future, whether or not he believes he can achieve his career goals pursuing the NFL, if he maximizes his, you know, eligibility for an extra year, or if he comes up big and ends up playing five more games, that could be enough to give him what he needs to take that next step to the NFL. But I think the biggest thing is that he would have to look himself and his brothers in the eyes and say, you know, I'm not going to play for you guys. And I just can't imagine that he would do that. How special is this season? How special is this moment that you wouldn't want to be out there contributing for your team, especially when there's a gaping hole that you are perfectly, you know, created to fill? 100%. I can't imagine. So, you know, I think ultimately it really is going to come down to what does McMillan's health look like going into that Oregon State game? And then ultimately, you know, is Giles the perfect substitute, or will he be an addition? And if he's an addition, maybe he sits, but I think he's playing no matter what.
Yeah, I just knowing that news about McMillan, especially, I would be shocked if there's any other conclusion to that.
So let's talk a little bit about the Oregon game, and then we'll circle back and talk a little bit about the rankings that came out tonight. Yeah. So walk us through what you saw in this Oregon versus Cal game that on paper looked like a total blowout, but the way that it started was not exactly how you would have drawn it up.
Yeah, it was. So I don't have the Pac-12 network. So I was forced to listen to this game on the radio, and We had my in-laws in town, so we were out on a little bit of an outing. We're in the car as the game's kicking off. So my father and I are listening in the car as we're driving home. And this first quarter was just this weird, chaotic, sloppy quarter in so many ways. Oregon had come into the Cal game with 2 turnovers on the entire season. They turned the ball over twice on their first, I think their first 3 possessions. Bo Nix threw an interception that bounced off of his brother, the receiver, Tez Johnson, just hits him in the chest, bounces into the arms of a defender. Then they had a fumbled snap where poor Tez Johnson, was running behind the center, and the center, I guess, maybe snapped it a second too soon, and it hit Tez Johnson in the leg. Cal scoops it up and scores. So they doubled their number of turnovers for the year in the first quarter. They had multiple touchdowns called back for penalties, including a blocked field goal that they ran all the way back for a touchdown, and that came back because the guy who blocked the kick had lined up in the neutral zone. It was just this comedy of errors. At one point, it's 14-13, and my father-in-law says to me, "What's going on with your Ducks?" And that was about five minutes to go in the second quarter, 14-13. And by halftime, it was 35-13. Like, that's how quickly the switch got flipped. You know, Oregon figured things out from there. Obviously, they won by 44 points. And Tez Johnson, he was, you know, directly responsible for the first turnover, indirectly responsible for the second turnover, bounces back, had by far his best game in an Oregon uniform, 12 catches, 180 yards, scored a 48-yard touchdown on a 2nd and 37, and also added a 47-yard punt return for good measure. So he was definitely player of the game, despite a really rough start.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, you're looking at it now, and I can't even remember how many points the Huskies put up on Cal, but feels 59. Like it was, what was that?
59.
Oregon put up 63, USC put up 50. I mean, Cal was supposed to be a team that, you know, had a struggling offense, but was solid on defense. Have they just completely fallen off the rails, or are these offenses just so superior that they're, you know, they just are over, you know, overpowering a great defense or a good defense?
I really don't know what the explanation is. I mean, Justin Wilcox, I think for a long time, has been one of the more respected defensive minds in the game, going back to his time at Boise, and continuing through his time at Washington. So it's pretty baffling because, yeah, you could always kind of count on Cal to give you a strong defensive outing, and their offense was suspect. Their offense has been better this year. They've had some productive outings. I don't know whether it's, I'd be interested to know like how many guys they lost in the portal. I'd be interested to know what kind of injuries they have. I just don't know enough about their roster to know if this is just a depleted team or if the guys that he's bringing in just aren't the same caliber that Cal has had in the past. But it certainly puts Justin Wilcox, a guy who has ties to both Oregon and Washington in his past, puts him in a precarious position going forward. And it's interesting, Warren, because if you remember when Dan Lanning was first hired, shortly after he was hired, there was a letter that surfaced that had been signed by Joey Harrington and Marcus Mariota and a number of other well-known Oregon alums that was pretty much urging the athletic director to hire Justin Wilcox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that I was that well.
And the letter came out, the existence of this letter came out after Lanning was hired, but the letter had been put forward before Lanning's hiring was made. So it wasn't that this group of players was voicing a displeasure with Dan Lanning as the choice, but it kind of felt that way in the mm-hmm. timing of when the story broke, because it was very much like, oh, these alums don't even want this guy. They wanted their guy, Justin Wilcox, to come back because they felt like Oregon had kind of lost touch with the history of who they were as a program. And man, it's hard to look at what Lanning has done in a year and three quarters compared to what has happened at Cal and how the bottom has just fallen out in a real way, and think that Oregon would be in better shape with Justin Wilcox at the helm.
Without a doubt. I mean, Dan Lanning has been really a fantastic hire for the Ducks. And, you know, I think everybody knew when people were talking about Wilcox, I think, well, I'll say at least for Husky fans, we were like, oh, that would be perfect, because he is just a mid coach. He is just, he's going to be good enough to keep them competitive, but bad enough to keep them from being elite.
Right. And so a Clay Helton type hire.
Well, maybe I think he would have been a little bit better than Clay Helton, although he doesn't seem to be particularly interested in recruiting. But I mean, I think he would have been a guy that was, you know, putting together 9-3 seasons pretty regularly, which, you know, that's great for most teams, but that's not what Phil Knight's paying for. So,
right.
You know, and speaking of, you know, getting what he paid for, the Ducks did come in once again at number 6 in the country as the highest ranked one loss team in college football. Washington came in again at number 5 as the lowest ranked Power 5, undefeated team. So we're back where we were, in spite of the fact that Washington beat a ranked USC team on the road. It wasn't enough to sway voters to move them above any of the, you know, Florida State, Georgia, Ohio State, or Michigan. We know that Ohio State and Michigan are going to play, and that's going to at least rub one of those out of the top 4 temporarily. But I think for me, as I'm looking at this, you know, there's two ways to think about it. Like, does this matter at this point? And I think on the one hand, yes, it does matter. On the other hand, no, it doesn't matter. So I'd be interested to hear your feedback on this. But I think, you know, the argument for why it does matter is that if we were number 1 in the country, like Ohio State is, we lose a game between now and the end of the season, and then we beat Oregon in the Pac-12 championship, I think we still get in to the CFP. If we're number 1 in the country and we win out and we lose to a one-loss Oregon, I think we still stay in, you know, assuming that there's a little bit of mayhem at the top. But being at number 5, ultimately what the CFP is saying to the University of Washington is, you literally have no room for error. You cannot absorb a loss and expect to make it into the college football playoffs. Ironically, it seems like the road for Oregon is still there, where if they can win out, they can absorb that one loss better than the University of Washington. So I would say on that side, yes, it does matter greatly. On the other side, no, it doesn't matter. Because I think we've always known that we were going to have to win every game to get there. And there's a part of me that's kind of glad that the Dogs are being told that they're not good enough to get in.
Yeah.
So that they keep that edge, and that they don't rest on their laurels. And, you know, they go into this Utah game saying, we've got to, you know, play our very best to prove that we're worthy. And that they do the same thing against Oregon State, Washington State, and then ultimately we would presume Oregon. So on that side of the equation, I'm like, hey, whichever scenario you look at, I think you have to, you know, take the position as a Washington fan. It's win out or be kept out. And if we win out, we are going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of seeing it. And I had somebody ask me earlier this week, well, in like, what would it take to get two teams from the Pac-12 in? Isn't this like a brand thing? If this were Alabama and Georgia or Ohio State and Michigan, if they were both 12-1, they would get in, wouldn't they? That was kind of the question. And I don't think that's actually the setup this year. I think what we're seeing this year is there's going to be a disproportionate number of either teams with zero losses or one loss. Like in the hit, since we've gone to the 4-team playoff format, there has never been a point in November where there were five major conference teams still undefeated. And that's what we have right now. And if you just kind of play it out and again, you start penciling teams in and saying, assuming they went out.
Right.
You know, there could be 7, 8, even 9. There's a scenario where there could be 9 one-loss teams or zero-loss teams at the end of the year that the committee has to juggle, where they're comparing resumes of like, well, what do we do with 12-1 Texas or 11-1 Ohio State or, you know, different things like that. And if you go back, I won't bore our listeners.
But you're not, Mark, you're not suggesting, though, that the committee would take a one-loss team if there was still 4 undefeated
teams. No, yeah, I think the 4 undefeated teams, there's 5, but you're right.
There's 5 now, but let's say that we know there'll be at the most 4.
At the most 4. If those 4 teams win out, I think it's locked and loaded, those 4 teams.
Yeah. So the real question is, what happens if you have 3 undefeated teams? How do you determine who that 4th team is with the one loss?
That's when it gets chaotic. If any of these teams, and so that would be Washington, Florida State, or Georgia, if any of them take a loss, or if we get some sort of 3-way tie between Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, then it starts to really get interesting. We're comparing resumes of who know, you know, if it's Oregon who gets in there, if it's Alabama who beats Georgia, if Texas is still 12-1, like then it gets really complicated. And the undefeated teams are in the best position. All of them can win their way into that final 4. And after that, it's dicey for everyone.
Yeah. And there's no way that there would be a situation where there would be 3 zero loss teams and Oregon's being considered as the only one loss team. That's not possible, because we know that Michigan or Ohio State is going down. So that actually down to 4. If Oregon beats Washington, then that would knock it down to 3.
Correct.
So, you know, that would work, wouldn't it?
No, what you're saying is there is no way that if Oregon finishes 12-1, there's no way that there's 4 undefeated teams that take a spot. Like they would at least have to be considered for that spot with some other teams.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's win out or be kept out. And, you know, Mark, we were talking, or I guess we were, you know, in a text thread talking about kind of what the ideal scenario was. Kind of walk me through what you proposed you thought Husky fans would most want. And I kind of shared, I didn't think that was the answer.
Well, this was just in reaction to the current rankings, which are today, which, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Ohio State 1, Georgia 2, Florida State 3, and Washington 4. Is that correct?
No, Washington is still 5.
So Washington is 5. We're presuming they would move up to 4 if Ohio State beats Michigan. So what I was saying is, let's assume the rankings hold. Ohio State finishes 1, Georgia finishes 2, Florida State finishes 3, and Washington finishes 4. The contention that I would make is, while Washington fans may be disgruntled about the number 4 ranking, I think what's more important is to take into account the matchup that you're matched up with. And that in this particular year, if Georgia is the 2 seed I would rather be the four seed and play someone other than Georgia. And if that means playing Ohio State, who has a first year quarterback, who has had an offense that has looked suspect in some of their bigger games, like against Notre Dame and Penn State, where they've really struggled to score. If I was rooting for a Washington team that's had a defense that's had some issues against good offenses, then I think I would say Washington is probably a better matchup against Ohio State than they are against Georgia or Florida State. Certainly against Georgia. I'm just of the mind you would want to avoid Georgia as much as possible. You would want to be on the other side of the bracket than Georgia and hope somebody else knocks them out and that you play whoever beat Georgia in the title game, just because they're the two-time defending champs and they haven't lost, you know, since like we had a different president. So like,
yeah, exactly. I mean, they've got the longest winning streak in the country. You don't want to go up against them unless you absolutely have to. Yeah, I think that would not be my dream scenario. And there's two reasons for that. Number one, I really want to see Washington finish in the top two, because by doing so, they would be then placed in the Rose Bowl instead of, you know, having to travel across the country. That's a tremendous advantage for Husky Nation to be able to travel to that game. There's the historical and nostalgic, you know, component to that. You know, in the final season of the Pac-12, wouldn't you want to be in the Rose Bowl for that, you know, champion, for that, you know, semifinal game? So I've got Washington at number two playing number three FSU. And, you know, I know that, like, from a matchup standpoint, FSU does have a great running team. They've got a great running game. They've got a mobile quarterback. They've got some tall wide receivers who are dynamic. But I think this FSU team is the softest of the four teams in the top 10, or the top four. I think they're coming out of the weakest conference. They're the least battle tested. They have, in my opinion, the poorest resume. So I like our chances again. Like, if you were just say, who do you feel like you have the best chance of beating out of these four? I'm going to take FSU. And if I can take FSU, who's having to go across the country to play in California versus Washington, which is almost, you know, in their home state, you know, in comparison, I'm going to take that game every day. So that's what I'm hoping for. And, you know, someone might be listening going, well, how is Washington going to get up to number two in the nation? I think there's definitely a pathway forward if they win out. You're looking at them finishing off their season, beating three ranked teams, beating number 18 Utah, beating number 16 Oregon State, beating their rival Washington State, and then playing what could potentially be at that moment the number four or five team in the country in Oregon. If we were to beat you guys, how could you not move Washington to, you know, the top two or three? I mean, to me, I think
in that scenario, though, Warren, I think you have potentially a nightmare situation, which is I think if Washington wins out and Florida State wins out, I think Washington jumps Florida State because Florida State doesn't play anybody in the top 25 for the rest of the
regular. Yeah, and that's why I've got them at three.
And so I think Washington moves above them, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't see how Washington, from where they are now, even playing Utah, Oregon State, and Oregon, I don't see how they jump Georgia, who would claim wins over Ole Miss, Tennessee, and Alabama. And I don't see how they get over Ohio State, who would claim wins over Michigan and then win the Big Ten championship. I don't know. That's a lot to ask. You'd basically be asking the committee to move Ohio State from one to three and move Georgia up to one, move Washington up to 2. I don't think that's totally unreasonable, but I think it's I guess what I'm saying is you could end up as the number 3 team playing number 2 Georgia, and then moving up past Florida State feels good in the moment, but then it's also like I think we'd rather just be at 4. It's kind of where I'm at.
That's true. And I mean, you know, first of all, we're presuming that all these teams remain undefeated. Obviously, Michigan being the odd man out. And we've already discussed how incredibly unlikely that scenario truly is.
Yeah.
You know, as great as Georgia is, I mean, for them to have to beat Alabama again, you know, to beat Ole Miss, to beat Tennessee on the road, you know, that's a tough schedule for them. Florida State's definitely got the easiest pathway to getting to the CFP. But yeah, I just think that if, you know, you look at it and you go, okay, who is the highest ranked, one loss team, it's Oregon. If you beat that team 2 times in one season, and that's the only, Washington is the only team to beat that team, how can you not say this is one of the top 2 teams in the country after beating all these other ranked teams in a historically good Pac-12, you know, conference? So, I mean, again, I'm the homer. This is the Dog and Duck Show. I'm going to put out positive vibes for the dogs. but I think that, like, I'm okay with our ranking where we are right now. But if we beat 3 more ranked teams, I think the resume says we're good enough to be in that top 2.
I mean, time will tell. It'll be interesting to see what kind of carnage comes around us. You know, if you look at, like, ESPN has their, like, percentage of victory in each game, you know. And so if you look at these contenders, you said Florida State has the easiest pass. Of all of the undefeated teams, they're the only team that ESPN gives a greater than 50% chance of finishing the regular season 12-0.
Right.
Which is pretty stunning to think about that. If you're just going by odds, they've got Ohio State 43%, Georgia 36%, Washington 35%, Michigan 24%. Obviously, Michigan and Ohio State play each other, which is part of why they're so low. But even for Georgia and Washington, where, again, you can pencil in wins, but they're looking at it and they're saying, maybe 1 out of 3 times this team could run the table. But it's anything but a guarantee. And the likelihood of 4 teams making it through these respective gauntlets is the part that's really unlikely. You know, chances are 1 or 2 of these teams will emerge.
Yeah.
And then we'll look at it and we'll say, oh, it makes sense that they were one of the 1 or 2 teams that did. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Florida State's got Miami and then North Alabama and then, you know, Florida, who's been up and down this season, and then they'll most likely face Louisville, which is like the lowest ranked championship game out of all the major conferences. So
Mario Cristobal could do us all a big favor by knocking off the Seminoles this week.
He would become a favorite to both Dogs and Ducks after that.
And, well, and Steve Sarkisian could do us a big favor by dropping a game that he's not supposed to win, not supposed to lose. So
true.
Those are the 2 coaches that could do us the most favors.
That's true. Well, let's talk about, speaking of Sarkisian, let's talk about Oregon versus USC this weekend. Like I said, as we reviewed the Washington USC game, Oregon fans have got to be licking their chops seeing the way that Dylan Johnson ran for 256 yards, 4 touchdowns, 199 yards before he even, you know, got touched by a USC defender. You know, if all things were to stay the same, you would have to expect that Bucky Irving would run for 400 yards by halftime. But things are not the same. As it turns out, Alex Grinch has been released as the defensive coordinator for the USC Trojans. So do we really know what to expect from this USC defense going into Saturday's game, Mark?
I have texts that I could read to you of, I think, like, from the USC Cal game, where USC is in this shootout with Cal, and I had a buddy texting me and saying, like, as Oregon fans, are we rooting for USC to beat Cal because we want them to keep a high ranking, or are we rooting for them to lose to Cal? Like, we were trying to discern that. And what my contention has been all along is I wanted them to lose to Cal, fire Grinch as the defensive coordinator, promote some interim for the Washington game, and the interim, you know, gets these guys to play like their hair is on fire, and the Trojans pull the upset. So the way I was painting the picture in my mind as, like, worst possible scenario for Washington is to have to deal with the interim coordinator instead of Alex Grinch. Of right. course, that's now the scenario that has come to pass for Oregon. And so I can talk myself reasonably, and I can say, hey, chances are that, like, a team that didn't know how to tackle a week ago isn't just going to magically learn how to, like, tackle ball carriers and cover receivers, you know, these kind of basic fundamental things. But Warren, there are so many examples of interim coaches giving a team a lift. Just last week, Arkansas, they scored 3 points against Mississippi State. They fired their offensive coordinator. They promoted an assistant. And then they went out against Florida and they scored 39 points, which is more points than they've scored all year. They pulled an upset over Florida. And everybody is giving credit to this promoted offensive coordinator who mixed things up. And I think that sort of play calling is maybe a little easier to conceive of on the offensive side than the defensive side. But still, USC has athletes. Like, it's not like these guys are, like, you know, just like an inferior form of athlete. Like, these were all highly recruited defensive players, many of them, like, big time transfers that came in from other schools with the expectation that they were going to bolster this defense this season. Yeah. So there is a small part of me for sure that is like, this is all kind of like worst case scenario here for Oregon to win this particular game, to have the incompetent defensive coordinator replaced by anybody that takes a little bit different approach to running a defense.
Absolutely. You know, of course, there is the opposite example, which would be after John Donovan got fired. And, you know, they, I think they turned to a shared coordinator position with, you know, Junior Adams and, I can't remember who else was calling plays with him. And they threw in Heward, and he ended up having like 3 interceptions. And it was the most embarrassing Apple Cup loss in years. So, you know, it could certainly go that way as well. It could be that all of the USC players give up and, you know, don't put any effort into it. I mean, who knows what Caleb Williams' state is going to be going to this game.
That is something I wanted to talk about, because did you see at the end of the Washington game when Caleb Williams went over to his mother?
And he was obviously, you know, heartbroken that they had lost. You know, it demonstrated that, you know, his heart was still completely in this game, this team, this season. Do you think that has changed now?
I mean, I don't know that it's changed, but I think that, I mean, I think he's a competitor, right? And, like, he was clearly had everything riding on that game. That doesn't mean he's not going to get up off the mat and, like, put everything into this game. I would expect him to. But I do think that when a team comes in with really high expectations, and for a team like USC, I'm sure, like Oregon and Washington, they were talking about Pac-12 championships, which they're still very much in the mix for. But they were talking about national titles or college football playoff and stuff like that amongst themselves. They've got a Heisman winner coming back to play again. And to lose to Notre Dame, to lose to Utah in a game that came down to the wire, to lose to Washington in a game that was very competitive into the fourth quarter. Like, that takes a lot out of you emotionally. And I just know, as being an Oregon fan, I can think of Oregon teams that I rooted for where they took their first loss of the season, and I, in my mind, am saying, okay, that's okay. We regroup, we win the rest of our games, we can still go to the Rose Bowl. And then they just have another performance that where they're, it's just clear that the wind has been taken out of their sails, because they put so much into those initial goals. And once they kind of lost sight of those, it was hard to kind of keep going in the same way. Football is such an emotional sport. These are 18 to 22 year old kids that are, you know, subject to a lot of different whims.
Yeah.
And I think that Oregon is going to have plenty of motivation, put it that way. Like, I don't look at this game as a team where, like, Oregon is going to come in and try to coast, and USC is going to surprise Oregon by being the more motivated team. I think it's much more likely that Oregon makes a few plays early that kind of take the wind out of their sails, and the crowd gets into it, and it just becomes a little bit harder for the Trojans to keep that fortitude. I think that would be the more likely scenario.
I do agree with you on that. But with the scenarios, if USC were to win, would that put them in the driver's seat for the number two spot in the championship game? Because that would be two losses, but both would have they'd have a head-to-head.
It would create a log jam with whoever else finishes the year with two losses. And so that could be Arizona, that could be Utah, that could be Oregon State, that could be Oregon. Like, it's kind of hard to know without knowing exactly how many teams we're talking about. They'd obviously have a tiebreaker over Oregon if they beat Oregon, and they'd have a tiebreaker. They already have a tiebreaker over Arizona. They would not have a tiebreaker over Utah, but if Utah loses to Washington, that might take care of itself. And if the Beavers were to lose another game to either Oregon or Washington, then that would really open the door for USC to earn their way back into the Pac-12 title game if they can beat Oregon.
Yeah. So there really is no excuse for them to give up on this season. I mean, like you said, other than pursuing a national championship, there are lots of big goals still ahead for this team.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see what kind of team you get. Are they going to be more, you know, disunified or disinterested after this week? Are they just not good at all on defense, and Oregon's just going to rack up, you know, 400 rushing yards against them? There's really no way to tell, but clearly Oregon right now is firing on all cylinders. So for USC to beat Oregon, they're going to have to play their best game of the year, and they're going to have to do something that would cause Oregon to really stumble and make some critical mistakes that they haven't been making this year. You know, and then I think, you know, kind of any other thoughts on that before we turn to Utah?
No, I think, I mean, that's it. It would have to be like the four turnovers or five turnovers type of
which they haven't done. I mean, like you said, they only have four turnovers for the whole year.
And I think coming out of the Cal game and having those and having the coaching staff is going to be riding these guys hard all week. It's hard to imagine them playing a sloppy game with everything that's at stake and considering the opponent. So I mean, the other scenario is they just win in a shootout though, Warren. Like can USC win a 49-42 game? I think Oregon's defense is good enough to withstand that and like make a few stops. But as long as Caleb Williams is involved, this is the second highest scoring team in the nation. So I do think that if you're painting the picture for a USC win, that's the picture. It's a high scoring shootout where they just outlast the Ducks. And I think that's certainly a possibility.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Huskies come into Saturday's game at home, 12:30 p.m. Big time game, sold out stadium that was just announced earlier today. And so, Husky Stadium is going to be rocking, and the Huskies are coming in as nearly 10-point favorites. And I think really the question that most of us fans are going to be asking is, which Utah team are we getting? Are we getting the Utah team that got obliterated by Oregon 35-6, or the one that just, throttled Arizona State 55-3? And, one of the terms that we use a lot in our text threads is transitive properties. We're always saying, well, if this team did this to this team, then that means that they would do this to this team over here. And that can make your head spin when you start looking at some of the results within the Pac-12. And, Washington barely squeaks by Arizona State. Oregon throttles Utah, and then Utah, destroys Arizona State. It's like, okay, how do you make sense of any of that? Does that mean that Washington is going to beat Utah by 120 points? No, that's not, that's not how it works. So, right. I think really, the big question is going to be, can Washington do what they need to do to stop the running game of Utah, which is their primary form of offense without Cam Rising? And how good is this Utah defense? Can they slow down? Can they stop Michael Penix and Dylan Johnson and, this dynamic offense? So I think that's going to really be the story. But having seen what Utah looked like against Oregon, what are your thoughts or, impressions about this game?
Well, a couple things. One, in terms of Utah's rushing attack, the story coming into the Oregon game was the converted safety Sione Vaki. And he only got, I think he carried the ball 5 times against Oregon and then kind of limped off with an injury. And I didn't see him in the box score against Arizona State, which makes me wonder if he's now out, which would be, the season Utah's had with injuries is just really unfortunate if he's another one that now has been exiled to the sideline. But they ran all over Arizona State without him, so they seemingly have some guys that they're able to hand the ball to, but he was not one of them. And I don't know if maybe that's just that they just put him back on defense and that he's just playing over there. I have not done the research. I just happened to notice that. I think the thing that I noticed, though, that would give me the most hope if I was Washington is Utah, despite being a very respected defensive team, Oregon came into that game really feeling like they could throw on them. And Dan Lanning usually defers on the coin toss, but he said in this game he wanted the ball first because he wanted to go down and score right away. And Bo Nix was something like 13 of 14 in the first half. He just shredded the Utah secondary. And if Oregon can do that, Washington can do that, right? And maybe even more so. And so I think that was a pretty interesting development. Utah statistically has the best pass defense in the Pac-12. So other teams haven't been able to find those yardage. But again, if you're looking for one team to be able to do what Oregon did against them through the air, I would think Washington is the team that could take advantage of that for sure.
Yeah, it was interesting. Ryan Grubb was asked, what did Oregon do that made them so successful against Utah? And I thought his answer was spot on, but he said really two things. Number one, they didn't make any mistakes. So Oregon, played a pretty mistake-free game, not just in terms of turnovers, but, high level of execution. And then number two, he said that they were really patient. And so he talked about how, you know, and Washington fans have been kind of quick to criticize Bo Nix for not doing a lot of down the field passes. But, you know, he really pointed out that that short game really set up Oregon to be able to go deep later on in the game. Yeah. And so I think it's good. It's good to hear that Ryan Grubb is looking at what Oregon has done and saying they were smart to do it this way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want to have that offensive coordinator that's like, you know, oh, they don't know what they're doing. I'm going to do it my way. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Hopefully he goes into it going, okay, if we want to have a similar result as Oregon in this scenario, maybe we should go wide before we go deep. Yeah. Maybe we should, you know, try to spread and then attack. And so I have no, like, if we get on the show next week and you're like, oh man, they copied all of Oregon's answers on the test, I'll be like, yeah, that was pretty smart.
Right.
Because Oregon came in with a great game plan, and there's no reason to try to reinvent the wheel if they can at all replicate what Oregon did.
Yeah, now, I mean, the interesting thing is Utah's game against USC, who was another high-powered offense, was much different, right? And they, I mean, that was a 34-32 game. So USC scored 32 points, but seven of those came off a pick six. So holding Caleb Williams to 25 points is a real accomplishment. And so yeah, they had some real success in that game. That's probably, I would guess, Caleb Williams is kind of least effective game of the year. Well, I guess the Notre Dame game was the worst, but
for sure.
But I mean, to hold Caleb Williams to 256 yards and 25 points is something. So I'm sure that they're going to make some adjustments off of what Oregon did to expose them. I mean, they are an incredibly well-coached team. But Washington is also an incredibly well-coached team, so it'll be an interesting chess match. It's just Utah's so limited offensively with Bryson Barnes as the quarterback, and I would assume that Trice and ZTF and those guys are really going to get after him the way that Oregon did as well. So that for the Utah defense to slow down Penix and company, to give their offense a chance to win the game, it would just take a monumental effort, I think, for them to make enough stops and force enough turnovers and do enough things on that side of the ball to really give that offense a chance.
No, I agree. And especially doing it on the road and in a sold out Husky Stadium. I mean, I just think, man, that's a tall order. And so, assuming that everybody on the Husky roster that we're expecting to play is able to play and is fully healthy, you know, I think that 9.5 point, you know, differential is pretty accurate. I wouldn't be surprised if the Huskies win by a couple touchdowns. But as we've seen with the ASU and the Stanford games, like, you never know. I mean, the Huskies have proven that they can beat anybody in the country, but they've also proven that they can get into some games that are a lot closer than they're supposed to be. So
if you told me at the beginning of the year that Washington would have a 15-7 win in Pac-12 play, I would have bet just about everything that I owned that it came against Utah, right?
Like, right, right. That would have been
choice number one.
If you had actually looked at the Huskies' record against ASU over the last 20 years, then you might have said, maybe it's ASU.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's go ahead and we'll wrap it up. But, the beats keep coming and they don't stop coming. It is a great time to be a dog and a duck. Let's get another W for both teams so we can keep this thing going. But for all my dog fans out there, Go Dawgs.
And for all my Duck fans, go Ducks.
All right, guys. We'll catch you next time.